Welcome to Thoughts from Home, your conservation podcast from the National Conservation Training Center. We're located along the Potomac River in historic Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and are home to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
I'm Randy Robinson, Outreach Coordinator here at the NCTC, and today we're talking about migratory birds and how we humans can help our feathered friends. We're very happy to have two biologists from the Fish and Wildlife Service Migratory Birds Division join us, Joelle Gehring and Joanna Lutmerding. Welcome to you both, and thanks for taking time to chat today.
Thank you, Randy.
Great to have you here. So, Joelle, what do we mean when we use the term migratory birds?
Yes, thank you. Well, there are formal definitions, but my favorite definition is these birds that migrate long distances. And it's a very inspiring and creates a lot of awe for me to think about these birds, some of which breed north of the Arctic Circle in places that I've never had the opportunity to even see. And they migrate down through Canada and through the United States, going through Mexico, sometimes over the Gulf of Mexico or out over top of some of these oceans, and spend their, what we consider to be, winters in warmer places. Some of our migratory birds aren't flying quite that far, but they are moving in some northward and southward pattern throughout the year to follow the food sources, to follow the warmth, and to continue this full annual cycle of their lives.
It is amazing to even just think about. It's kind of mind-boggling. But Joanna, why do birds migrate? It seems kind of risky for such little birds, hummingbirds and so on. Why do they migrate, and what can we learn by observing the birds that go these great distances?
Thank you for that question. And to start with, I'd just like to say that we see birds everywhere and all the time in every season, but we don't always see the same ones, and that's because of migration. So, for example, in our yards, around our homes, year-round, we may see our resident species, cardinals, chickadees, woodpeckers, crows. And so these are species that have learned to adapt to an area year-round, and they may only need to move very short distances. But then, as the seasons change, we start to see new characters coming and going. So, for example, in the winter, we are having birds show up that bred in northern parts of Canada, and they have adapted to resources that are available even in the mid-Atlantic, places like Maryland, where I live, that are available all winter, and so they can take advantage of those, whereas other species, they have adapted to resources that are really dependent on the longer days, the warmer weather, and so they are the ones who migrate the longer distances, so they can take advantage of insects, flowers with nectar, fruits, seeds, that they're going to need to survive. So it's been a really amazing product of millions of years of evolution and species evolving to take advantage of the changing day length, different availability of resources. And it's just really amazing to get to turn our attention to that. And if we pay attention across the seasons, seeing these species change, even from the windows of our home, we can observe these changes throughout the year. And birds teach us many things. As someone who loves birds, I look to birds for beauty. We can catch glimpses of them when they're migrating, a flash of color in a tree, or a bit of song or a call when we step out of our home. And so it's a way for us to connect with the world around us and how beautiful it is. And speaking of connection, they also teach us that we're connected to them, that we are all connected. They link us across the world, across really vast landscapes, but also that what we do matters to them. So it's a reminder that our actions affect them as much as their beauty and song can affect us. And so it's a very intertwined connection that is really important for us to value.
I love to see the birds out, even in the wintertime, see that little flash of color, hear that little song. It always makes your day when you hear that or see that. But migration is a pretty amazing phenomenon. Joelle, how do birds migrate? And I've learned that they often migrate at night. Is that correct?
Yes, it's incredible. And when I think about how to get from NCTC into Washington, D.C., or wherever we're going, I need a GPS, and I just hope I have cell service to get me through that full navigation of a commute. These birds are hatched, and within months, they are embarking. Within months of hatching, they are embarking on an incredible journey. They don't have GPS. They don't have cell phones. They can't even use a paper map or phone a friend. They are using stellar constellations. They're using magnetic fields of the Earth, polarization of light along the horizon. Sometimes they're using landmarks, such as the Mississippi River or the Potomac. If they get really confused, sometimes they're using sunrise or sunset. They're using all of these variables that we are surrounded by all the time and may not notice, but they're using those to navigate long distances. And we're not just talking from Wisconsin to Mexico. We are saying they are migrating from potentially their nest site all the way down to a particular area in Central America, South America, the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, and then going all the way back up to that same specific spot. That's how refined it is. I get goosebumps when I think about it, and it's an incredible feat. And they're doing all of this, as Joanna mentioned, we are surrounded by it all the time. And some of us may see it, but not truly see it. And we may hear it, but not necessarily listen for it. And it's a beautiful way to connect with our planet. And these are incredibly special birds, and they're around us all the time. When we go take our kids to soccer practice, or we take out the garbage, or we walk the dog, or when we sleep at night, these birds are all around us. And they are indeed migrating at night, you mentioned, Randy. And that is another magnificent and mysterious thing. That how could we know they're there? How can we connect with them that way? We have several different ways that I'll let Joanna talk to you about, but it's an incredible feat that is indeed happening at night. Why at night? You know, it could have something to do with trying to avoid predation. The weather patterns tend to be a little bit more still at night, and it's just something that they've evolved to do over time. And these are birds that have the same kind of vision that we do overall. Their night vision is not necessarily excellent for most of those species. It's not a whole lot better than ours, but they can somehow use these stellar constellations and these nighttime climates to have mass blankets of migratory birds over top of us in the spring and the fall.
So, Joanna, can we see those birds migrate, or how can we do that? What's the best way to observe them?
Well, something that's also amazing about nocturnal migration is that you can observe it just by stepping outside and looking at the moon on a spring or fall night when migration is occurring. And it's interesting because this is something that also connects us through time. So this is something that our human ancestors could have done and may have done as well, is to step out on a clear night, look at the moon, and actually you can see the silhouettes of birds flying in front of the moon. And it's a really magical experience, as well as you might imagine. And if you listen, you can also hear them communicating with each other. So when they're flying in these flocks, they are chirping quite a bit. And some of those chirps are even distinctive. You can tell what species of bird it is by that chirp. So you can also train your ear to identify some of these species when they're moving overhead at night. So very easy. You don't have to have special equipment to get to witness this in that regard. So anyone can do it. And another thing that is now available to everyone is this incredible online tool called BirdCast. So this uses weather radar and our understanding of cues for migration to actually predict when birds are going to be moving at night and an estimate of how many are going to be moving. And then when the migration is actually occurring, this website will track the movements in real time. And so you can set up alerts on this website, and you can be told up to 3 days in advance that, hey, on Tuesday night, there might be 500 million birds flying over the U.S. that night. And then you could go back Wednesday morning and actually see how many were observed through the weather radar. And sometimes they are underestimates. So there was one night where they thought there might be 700 million birds. And then the next morning, they estimated there were actually over 1 billion birds that had migrated the night before. And when you just think about that volume, it's hard to imagine. And it's all happening while we're sleeping, for the most part, most of us. And just this phenomenon, magical thing happening with these birds, weigh a couple of ounces and are able to fly through the night without stopping, all while we're resting. So it's a wonderful tool, BirdCast. I hope that our listeners can check it out.
It is mind-boggling to think about those birds and those numbers, but I know those journeys are dangerous, even just with natural means, you know, like getting lost along the way. But we have a lot of human-caused problems that we put in their way. Joelle, could you talk a little bit about glass is especially bad for birds?
Yes. So glass is a challenge for birds year-round, but especially during migration when we have birds entering into areas that they may not have been before. And Joanna and I are runners. We know that we've never run all night, but if we did, we'd know that when we got done, we'd be hungry and tired and need a safe place to rest and refuel so that we could do it again the following night or a couple nights later. During migration, we have birds that are already exhausted and vulnerable and tired, and they may be landing in our yards, next to our dental offices, next to wherever, our schools, and they're a little vulnerable at that time. And it's massively in a new place, they're not familiar with it, and they don't see glass the way we do. So we look at a building and we see a wall with a square hole in it or a rectangular hole in it. We think, must be glass. They don't view the world that way, and they also seem to be confused by reflections in glass as well. So we've all seen, you know, reflections on our windows and on big shiny buildings. It looks like there's vegetation or sky, but we know it's glass. Birds don't understand that. And so they often fly into glass and it causes a fatal collision. Although many birds appear to fly away, and I myself have picked up birds that have hit my glass and tried to keep them safe before releasing them, I know now, since I've done that, that most of those birds, unfortunately, do not survive unless they're taken to a qualified rehabilitator who can help them, give them the services that they need, and then they can fly on their way, hopefully. But most of those birds are not receiving any medical care, and most of them are unfortunate fatalities, even if they initially fly away. So the most important thing is to stop it from happening. Birds are more likely to collide with windows near bird feeders. We're concentrating birds, maybe in our yards. We love feeding birds. I do. But those windows are then at higher risk for causing a bird collision. As many as 1 billion birds a year are colliding with glass. And that's a hard, heavy number to hear, but we have solutions. And that's where Joanna and I like to focus on, is solutions. We all like the windows in our homes, and we love birds. And we are happy to say that there are solutions that all of us can partake in. They're easy, inexpensive, and they're diverse in appearance. Some of those solutions actually save us money as well. In the past, I've said, I'll put up a hawk silhouette, or I'll put up a few glass decals, or they're kind of a plastic UV decal. I wish those worked, but they don't. And they just aren't enough. Birds still will fly between those. They don't see it as a hawk silhouette. They see it as a black blob, and they will fly next to it, below it, above it, whatever. They'll fly into the glass anyway. But what's most important is, yes, stuff on the glass to let the birds know needs to be on the outside of the glass, and it needs to be in about a 2-inch by 2-inch pattern or something like that. So birds will try to sneak through a bigger pattern than that, but a 2-inch by 2-inch pattern seems to be fine for them, and it really significantly reduces those bird collisions. And this is becoming more and more important to people around. More and more people are noticing bird collisions and jumping on this bandwagon, which is not just a bandwagon, it is a valuable thing to do. It is an immediate result. So what are they doing? Most of these collisions are occurring at homes and low-rise buildings, not necessarily even the taller buildings. and they're using products that are maybe a dot pattern that goes on the external surface of the glass. Some people are using a film, like a bus wrap that you might see, that has a different look to it than the dot pattern. Some people are using a paracord curtain, so paracord hanging down every 3 inches or so. Some people are just going with something simple and nice, like a tempera paint, which washes off with vinegar. And as long as they paint a pattern on the outside surface of the glass that somehow replicates a 2x with no spaces bigger than 2 inches, the birds will not fly through. It needs to be on the outside, and it needs to be in about a 2-inch by 2-inch pattern. I know my mom, one of her windows was causing a lot of collisions by her bird feeder. She loves to feed the birds. She's 82, and during the pandemic, she became increasingly more aware of the bird fatalities that she was causing, the birds that she loves. And I'll be honest, she didn't quite tell me how many birds were colliding. I would have been over there faster, but you know how it is with moms. So she started telling me, I'm getting nervous about these collisions, and it's kind of bothering me, and I'm hanging all these window sun things on the inside of my window. It's just not helping. And those were on the inside of the glass. The birds, it was not helping reduce bird collisions. So I said, let me fix it. So the first warm day that I was over there visiting her, I put up a dot pattern. It worked beautifully. And she said, you know, I was afraid I wasn't going to be able to see out my window. I thought, this, don't put anything on my glass, Joelle, that I'm not going to be able to see out my window and look at my birds, and that people are going to think my house looks crazy. She was concerned about that. But she's never been happier with the solution. And she's thrilled. And now she shares it with her family and friends. She's bringing brochures and handing it out. And they're applying this to their glass. And people feel good about it. And sure, people are excited, and they know they've had this issue for a long time, and it's eaten away at them a bit. But there's a solution, and it's not hard, and it's not expensive, and it is an immediate benefit to these birds that have been part of our culture for a long time, as Joanna was saying. My mom also tells me when the orioles arrive in the spring, when the sandhill cranes arrive, and I think it's when the sandhill cranes arrive that she can get her sandals out. And it's a part of her life. Birds are part of her life, as they are for many of us.
So that's awesome. I had a similar experience during the pandemic. You know, we're inside all day, mm-hmm. and you hear it when the bird, yes, hits, kind of a sickening sound. You don't want to hear it.
Yes.
That thump. I got tired of that. There weren't a lot, but there were, you know, one's enough. Too many.
Yeah.
And so I tried something a little bit different. You mentioned parachute cord. Mm-hmm. So I went online and figured out how to make what they call a Zen curtain.
Yes.
Which is simply vertical white cord hanging down about, yes, every 3 inches.
Yep.
And I did it myself. It was cheap.
Yep.
And it works, you,
yes,
know.
Yes, it does.
I have not, that was maybe 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's been a bird hit since then. One of the cool things is that if there's a little bit of a breeze, they actually, mm-hmm, move.
Yes.
And it breaks up the reflection.
Yes.
So that's a simple do-it-yourself kind of remedy. I think we all want to help,
yeah,
birds.
I made two of those curtains as well, Randy, and I made them with my son while we were watching a movie. And it was fun, and hung it up and immediately eliminated bird collisions with those windows next to my bird feeders that I had been experiencing many collisions with. And it was fun, and there are different options with different aesthetics, different costs. There are opportunities out there, and you are not alone in seeing an increase in collisions when you are spending more time at home. You are part of a bigger community that saw these issues happening more when you were at home and wanted to make a difference. And in the past 3-4 years, we have seen a significant increase in the number of people doing this. So we're part of a larger community, Randy, you and I. And you too, you treated your windows
sure
as well,
did.
Joanna. Yeah, in the last several years. And we are part of a growing community that wants to make a difference.
That's great. So, Joanna, there's something else that we can do, in many cases, fairly simple, as turning off a light switch. So tell us about how light affects birds.
Yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about light. And that is a focus of mine, is working to address light pollution, which is increasing globally, that we may not all realize just how bright our towns and cities have become and the sky glow that is around us, and how little now when we step outside, if we look up on what is typically a clear night, how many stars we can or can't see. So we are losing the visibility of our night skies compared to what we've had in the past. And this is another thing that connects us through time. It's only been in about the last 100 years that we have so much light at night. And prior to that, it was a very common experience. Someone this week even said it was probably the most common shared experience among humans through human history is to be able to step out of your home at night and look up and see a blanket of stars. Whereas today, you may look up and see maybe 100 stars, whereas in the past, you may have seen thousands. And so that's affecting us, but it is also affecting birds. So when birds are migrating at night, like we talked about earlier, they are using the stars to navigate and otherwise a dark sky. But now the Earth's surface is very well lit. And that is something that's very new when you think about animals that have existed for millions of years. So they are now reacting to that light. It disorients them, but it also draws them into the light. So they are attracted to lit structures, towers, buildings, parking lots, roadways. Anything that has a light can disorient and attract a bird to it. And then what we observe is that once these birds are drawn to these areas is that they can't escape. So they get trapped there and they may circle a tower or a building endlessly, exhausting themselves. So all of that energy that they saved up to run and or fly that marathon through the night is now being used around this building. So they're not making their targets where they had intended to land the next day. Now is going to wind up being very far away from where they are winding up because they are drawn into these lit areas. And then this shortens their migration. They may stop over, and then we start to see the impacts of the glass that Joelle just talked about. So these birds are now in these areas where there are a lot of buildings, a lot of glass, a lot of homes. That increases the risk of them colliding with the structure. Another issue, very easy to fix, and it benefits all of us. If we can turn off our lights at night, the ones that we don't need, so our unnecessary lighting, particularly when we go to bed, we don't need light while we're asleep. And so if we can keep the lights off, both in our homes, outside of our homes, in our communities, or at least dimmed to a lower level, downshielded, put on timers, put on sensors, any measure that we can take to reduce the lighting is going to help the birds. It's also going to help us as people because we've learned that all of the lighting is affecting our sleep at night, affecting our hormone cycles. So we are going to benefit. It's also affecting insects that are drawn in. They also get entrapped. And so if we can turn off or lessen the lights, they can continue on their normal behavior. And we need our insects. They are a very important part of our ecosystem, just as much as birds. And in fact, there's really no living thing that has been found to not be affected somehow by all of the light that we have in the environment. So turning it down is going to help us, birds, plants, animals, you name it, everything will benefit. And another way, if you need to keep the lights on at night in your home, close your curtains. Again, very simple, prevent the light spilling outside of your home. And once you've been able to take these actions and benefit from them, tell people about it. Share, build that community that Joelle talked about. More and more people care about these issues. You won't be alone. You're not going to be the only one to take these steps. But we do need to keep spreading the word and continue to build that community that are participating in this, that care, that take actions. And then they're going to tell others, and we're going to create that ripple effect, and we're really going to make a difference on this issue. I'm confident of that.
Speaking of making a difference, Joanna and Joelle were here this week at the National Conservation Training Center. You organized a summit to address light pollution and bird collisions. And could you give us a little summary of what went on there?
Mm-hmm. It was a huge team effort that organized it. And thank goodness we had such qualified people. But it was something that Joanna and a couple of other colleagues started thinking about last year. And, you know, why we have these issues with light pollution being a challenge for our bodies and our viewing of the night sky and bird migration. And we know birds are colliding with glass. We know they all fit together. But are we really talking to each other? Are we doing the best we can by the birds and by our human health and by our night sky viewing? And you know what it's like, you know, we have a lot of people who might agree on one issue and they might all feel strongly about it, but are we talking to each other about it? And so we were really excited to bring this together with our teammates. And yes, so we have a summit, so it's multi-sector. What does that mean? We brought together everybody we thought would have a vested interest in this and would be interested in making progress and really wanted to take strides and make progress on this issue. So we brought together people like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, some of our colleagues, the National Park Service, who also focuses on reducing light pollution. We brought together architects who are designing some of these buildings. We looked at some of the lighting designers who know a little bit more about the details of how does the light work, how can we do it better. We brought together people who are already talking about bird collisions with glass. And we brought together some policymakers as well to help us understand what that looks like, and people who really know how to communicate this message more and engage more people in the topic. And we really wanted to identify what was stopping us from making progress on this issue, more progress. We're making progress. There's a community, a growing community, but how can we get more people to join us? And what are the opportunities? How can we do it better and faster and for a healthier environment? And how can we restore some of the dark skies and bird populations that we've lost already? So we talked about some of the threats posed by glass and nighttime lighting. We tried to understand why we aren't completely changed and fixed if we know about those health benefits for all of us. And we're starting to talk about next steps today. We're in our last day. It was a pretty nice lineup. We had Jane Alexander join us, who provided a beautiful keynote speech, really emphasizing to us that conservation is a process and it takes all of us. It takes all of us to be a part. We can't defer to our lawmakers or our policymakers. We are all a part of this environment, and that means it may feel like a little bit of pressure, but it's empowerment. We all have the power to make a difference. Every person who uses a light bulb and every person who looks out a window has an opportunity and is empowered to make the world a better place for themselves and for birds and for night sky viewing. We had many experts come in from Cornell Lab of Ornithology talking about declining bird populations. Experts on birds and glass and night skies, talking about the history and the culture and how night skies are a resource for us and they're part of our history. And the North Star was so critical to many people as they traveled north to safety. And this is an important part of us. We had Dr. Brainerd come in and talk about the increased cancer rates from both men and women from exposure to nighttime lighting, and yet another huge reason for us to decrease night lighting and sleep and have dark environments at night. And then we talked about how can we make even beautiful high-profile buildings, such as the Javits Center in New York City and our beautiful Statue of Liberty Museum has bird-friendly glass. This is possible. This is beautiful. This is something that is very easy to do in the world. We just need to do it. We know what we need to do. We just need to do it. And we had some authors come in and talking about dark skies and what those mean to us. The lighting technologies, how to do it right, no, it's not so right. And we talked about how we are all connected. Dr. Paul Bogard is an author, a best-selling author. He came in and talked about his new book. Joanna, how do you say that word?
Solastalgia.
Solastalgia. Thank you. And that is his new book that talks about our connection to the earth, all of us, and what it means to us and how important it is to us. And so we heard about that. And then it was all wrapped up with Lily Taylor, another lovely actress who came and shared her story about participating in the Tribute in Lights at the 9/11 site and how New York City is doing a wonderful job at balancing, honoring those people we lost, as well as honoring the birds that are drawn into those lights. And how do we balance that? And they have observers on the ground. When the density of birds attracted into those lights shining up into the sky for that tribute, when that density becomes too high, they turn off the lights for a very short period of time. Is it 20 minutes, I think she said? 10 to 20 minutes.
That sounds right.
Lights are up for 10 to 20 minutes. We have a moment of darkness, and the birds continue on their way to be heading south that time of the year. And then the birds clear out and the lights can come back on again. And so it's working together to meet our goals of conservation and what we care about in this world.
Well, it was a very interesting summit. I learned a lot, and I appreciate your efforts and everybody in the Migratory Birds Division into organizing that. I learned about shielding lights. You know, you can actually save energy by directing the light, targeting the light where it needs to be on a footpath, for example, or a set of steps. Not only do you save energy, you save money because you save energy, but you're saving birds too.
Yes.
And even simple things like turning off the switch, putting devices or decals up on your windows to keep the birds away from them. Even such things that, you know, school kids could do them, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. As they say, it's not rocket science. There's something everybody could do. And I think we all want to help the birds. So I really appreciate your time coming in here today to talk with us on the podcast. Where can people go to get more information?
Yes. Well, we have beautiful websites on both lighting and on glass collisions. And the way I find it is I go onto Google and I just put in FWS for Fish and Wildlife Service. I put in FWS, birds, glass, lighting, and I get what I want from our websites. That's how I find it. And there you can find more information about how the simple changes that we might make can save us energy immediately and save birds immediately. And, you know, we have a growing community. People can feel good about what they're doing as they join this community of people who are making the world a better place for birds and for themselves at the same time.
Well, thank you both very much again for coming here.
Thank
Joanna
you
and Joelle,
thank
we
you.
Appreciate your knowledge and sharing the summit with us today.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the National Conservation Training Center podcast series. If you have feedback, thoughts, or stories you'd like to share, contact us at nctc_podcast@fws.gov.